Welcome, everyone, to the Our Strange Skies podcast. I am your host, Rob Christofferson, and I'm joined today by a fellow anomalous researcher, the documenter of the Donutverse. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, get your ass on Twitter and you'll get schooled. You'll understand after that what I'm talking about. But also just someone who's become a great friend, AP Strange, man. Welcome to the pod.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We have a tendency to like send each other down rabbit holes and stuff on Twitter. We'll DM each other like cases that we come across that tick some boxes that we may be, you know, looking into and stuff right now. But I'm always curious, what is it that sends you into a particular subject? Because you recently, for the Christmas season, covered real life sightings of Santa Claus. So what is it, what sends you down the research paths that you ultimately take?
Honestly, it can be literally anything. I can sometimes be watching a movie or a TV show and just get curious about some minute aspect of it and then just laser focus on it and keep Googling different things. Well, I don't necessarily need Google, but sometimes I'll pull a book off the shelf and I'll look into something. And I mean, I always have a stack of 5 to 7 books nearby that I was using as a reference for something or other. Like in the same Santa Claus sighting show, I was talking about vampires because I just happened to be reading some Montague Summers vampire for something else I was curious about recently and stumbled across a Christmas related vampire story. So I had to include that as well. So it's just really any, I have so many different varied interests. And if I find something that sticks out to me as a bit odd, it's like a little thread that I'll just keep pulling on until I have a huge pile of thread in front of me. And then I start weaving it into something else. So that's about it.
It's truly magical to watch it all happen because it's, if you follow AP on Twitter, you'll get a lot of very strange news stories throughout the day. They're always great because like there's always one that's just like so fucking weird that you can't help but just pause for a second. So it's the weirdness that I appreciate in my day every day.
Yeah, I'd go to a lot of effort for that because I'm trying to dig for news stories that are weird, but I don't like them to be too dark. You know, I try to stay away from the dark ones because you can end up in like weird murder stories or something like that. That's not really my bag. So I try to keep them light too. I think the vampire thing, the reason I took a book off the shelf was because there was one of the news stories I posted was about a breaking and entering case in my home state of Massachusetts where the intruder identified himself as a vampire and all he wanted was a pair of shoes. So And then I was like, hey, wait a minute, though. I think shoes are somehow a part of vampire lore. So I had to pull down my Montague Summers book and start reading about vampires. To try to figure out why vampires would want a pair of shoes. So
it's important. You know, it's very important. You got to know where this stuff connects. There's a great guy on a great account on TikTok. This guy who pretends to be a vampire hunter, and he talks about like the living this van life and like killing vampires and stuff like that. It's so fucking hilarious because he's trolling, but he sounds so serious every time he's talking, and I'm like, I cannot not do a Sean Manchester, you know, troll account. It's just got to happen now. Yeah. Because, I mean, that the Highgate vampire stuff from the 70s is just so fucked up. It's so weird.
Yeah, it's an outstanding story. That's that's a bunch of weirdness piled on top of itself. Because, I mean, yeah, you do have the people that can think they are vampires or portray themselves that way, too. So, in this day and age, I wouldn't put anything past anybody. You don't know what to believe at all anymore. So
No, you don't. And today we're bringing the listeners a case that is definitely on that don't really know what to think, but is definitely out there. And that's, we're headed to Wyoming today for really one of the strangest alien abductions that I can think of. And it's the abduction of Mr. Everett, but otherwise known as Carl Higdon. And from what I could tell, Carl was just a pretty average dude, like Family Guy. He worked as an oil driller. He actually worked like a lot of different jobs, from drilling wells to servicing and operating like the whole business himself. And he was in the trade for damn near like almost 50 years, something like that. He met his wife Marjorie in 1957, and they got married about 13 months later, and they raised 4 children, 2 daughters and 2 sons. In 1974, at the time of his abduction, Carl was 41 years old and employed by the A.M. Wells Service Company out of Riverton, Wyoming. He'd been an oil field driller for about 20 years at this point. And on the morning of October 25th, 1974, Carl was actually headed out the door when he got a call from one of his workers. He was sick with the flu, and when you're down a guy out and that doing that oil drilling, man, you can't do it. You just can't do it. So what else better to do than, you know, pick up that gun and go hunting? Why not?
Yeah. Elk hunting, no less.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we don't get elk up here. We just get the, you know, deer, but
might be my own ignorance too, but I mean, I didn't know people really hunted elk. I figured it was a protected species, but I guess maybe it wouldn't have been in 74. Maybe it still isn't, but it seems like an intense thing to hunt, you know?
Right. It seemed to be something that was like a Midwestern thing, you know, Montana, Wyoming, a few other states out there. But yeah, it just seems like weird. Elk hunting. Okay.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I could see shooting a deer and then tying it to your truck or whatever, but an elk would seem like immovable. Would you be able to pick up an elk by yourself?
Right, because you got to think, like, you've got your deer, and then you got your elk, and then you got your moose. Like, your elk is, it's not totally halfway between a deer and a moose, but it's pretty sizable. That'd probably be a pain in the butt to haul out.
I imagine you just take like the parts you want or something, right? I guess.
I mean, if you're gonna butcher it on site or something, yeah, I can see that. Carl had recently purchased a 7mm Magnum rifle, and he had set his sights on McCarty Canyon. And near the fork to the canyon, a group of hunters had broken down. And Carl actually stopped to help him out. Apparently, their battery had gone dead. And he just basically charged it up there for a little bit. They shot the breeze for a while, and they directed him to a remote part of Medicine Bow National Forest where the hunting was allegedly a lot better. So, all right, these guys pretty much set Carl on his path for what's about to happen. So are these guys aliens, or is this just a coincidence?
They could have been, or they could have been like Men in Black type figures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So wait, we know about these guys because of Carl's talking about it later, or were these witnesses that talked about seeing Carl beforehand?
We only know about
identify them.
No, they never identified them. These are just two people that Carl drove up on. I never found any other corroborating names or anything that came out later on during the investigation. But yeah, we just got some nameless folks that are broken down in the forest.
Yeah, I mean, it seems suspicious. Because, I mean, I've heard that argument made, too, about, or at least I've thought about it, is in the Lonnie Zamora case, where he takes off after some kid. It's like speeding through town. And then he just kind of ends up letting him go because he sees what he thinks is a fire off in the the desert, you know? So I always thought, you know, maybe that kid was, you know, not real or an alien or something like that, you know?
Yeah, just that one figure that's going to set you on your path to weirdness and, you know, ultimately quitting your job on the police department, which is unfortunate. It's not cool.
Yeah. I mean, he probably gave up a pension or something, but those people that just kind of set you on that course. I mean, if those people hadn't been there, I guess you might have gone a different way, you know? So
There's the extreme case in the case of the Soria abduction from Spain, in which I forget the witness's name, but he decided to go out hunting early on in the morning. He went in the wrong direction, and he stops at this diner. This diner does not open this early. It was like 4 or 5 in the morning. He goes inside. He is served a meal by some really strange looking people, and they tell him, hey, go hunt in this area over here. So he goes and he hunts in that area there. And what do you know? He gets abducted by aliens. It's apparently a tale as old as time.
Right. Yeah. It's just mysterious figures being put there to direct you, you know, just like set you on your way into a trap.
Yeah. So. And then, you know, sometimes it's a person broke down on the side of the road. Other times it's diner operators. Not only that, operating diners that do not belong to them and are not open at that time. So.
Yeah.
It's mysterious.
Very suspicious. So yeah. I guess the moral, the lesson we can take from this is that if you see somebody broke down on the side of the road, keep driving. Just don't get involved.
Yeah, the Good Samaritan rules are thrown out the window now because these damn aliens just ruin everything.
Yeah, they ruined it for everybody. So I'm sorry if you're broke down on the side of the road, you're SOL. I'm gonna keep driving.
Listen, folks, I'm just gonna say this: if the person that's passing you by on the side of the road has a UFO podcast, you understand why now. You just understand. This is how it works. But the day was it was beautiful. Autumn had finally come to Wyoming, and he had parked the company truck on a knoll, and he poured himself a cup of coffee. And upon surveying the area, an old friend and local game warden, Gary Eaton, approached him, and the two kind of just struck up a conversation for a little while. It was after about 4 o'clock when this happened, and then Gary headed up for higher ground, and he joked that he would scare some elk down for him. It was around 4 in the afternoon now. Yeah, that Carl, he poured the rest of the coffee back into his thermos, and he set off down a winding road beside the forest. He pushed deeper into the woods, up and down hills, until he came to a clearing. 5 elk stood in a group, and Carl took aim. He pulled the trigger, but something was off. It took him a moment to realize what happened. The bullet made no sound as it ejected from the chamber. And not only that, it only traveled about 50 feet before stopping midair and dropping to the ground. So, you know, totally what bullets do, right?
Well, he did. It was a brand new gun, right?
Yeah.
So he hadn't used it before. So, I mean, there is a possibility. If he bought that gun from Acme Products, I can tell you that I've had trouble with them before, too. So do not buy a catapult from Acme Products is all I'm telling you. So I assume that applies to guns as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's amazing they're still in business. Like, I don't get it.
Well, they're the first ones in the phone book. You know, they just...
That's fair. And I mean, we all know how important phone books are today.
I think the way it was described, it seemed like, okay, so there was no sound, and the bullet seemed to just slow down. Which I don't have a lot of experience with guns, but it's my understanding that that's not supposed to happen.
No.
And then it eventually comes to a stop about 50 feet away. It seems like a time slowing down effect.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it kind of reminds me of, you know, when you see somebody move in super fast in a movie, like the Quicksilver character in the X-Men movies or the Flash. You know, that you wouldn't even see them because they move so fast, but time slows down to show you what they do. It seems like a time slippage effect, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
When you put it in that way, it definitely puts the next moment into a certain perspective. Because, you know, he watches the motion of that bullet slow, and he says that the movements of it falling to the ground are almost like a butterfly, and the bullet settled on the ground, and the elk just stood there motionless. They didn't hear the bullet either.
Yeah, I mean, that's one upside to it, is that he didn't, like, you know, scare off the elk with a gunshot noise, at least.
Yeah.
At least they were still there.
That's important. That is totally important. So that's when he noticed, too, that the forest had become very silent. Everything was just completely quiet. And it felt like a clap of thunder was headed his way. He described it that moment right before that thunderclap hits. And Carl knelt down, picked up the bullet, and placed it in his canteen pouch. Then the silence was broken by the snapping of a twig underfoot. Turning to his left, a rather odd man was standing there. Carl lowered his gun, but the man's odd features stood out. So, pretty much, Carl shoots this gun, bullet goes nowhere. We got some distorted time effect here, and a very strange-looking dude just shows up out of nowhere. It's fucked up. It's just fucked up.
It sounds like a nightmare, sort of, you know, or like the precipice of losing consciousness. You know, it almost seems like the onset of an altered state or something like that. You know, very, very odd. Time slowing down, things defying physics. And the important part of that, though, is I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit, because we got to describe this guy that he sees. But the bullet itself, it was analyzed later. So, I mean, you have physical evidence from this, which is pretty astounding.
Yeah, there is a decent amount of not just physical evidence, but like beyond the pale kind of strange physical evidence.
Right. Yeah, a whole bunch of things. But yeah, we should get into the description of this guy, because he's one odd-looking alien.
He is. So he stood roughly 6 feet tall, and though his straw-colored hair made him seem taller as it stood on end, the length of his hair was just noticeably uneven. So clearly he hadn't been to a barber, or they really have terrible hair maintenance on their planet or wherever they're from. But
or there's a time effect where some of it grows longer than others because, you know, he's distorting time everywhere he goes.
Holy crap, we've nailed it. We've got it now. This is what's happening. And that is utterly terrifying. If I was a being on another planet and my hair grew at exponentially different rates, I wouldn't have hair. I'd just shave it all off.
Just parts of his scalp are in different modes of time unspooling.
Now I'm just picturing a man whose scalp has different time zones. So, yeah. You know, yeah, one's Eastern, one's Pacific. Yeah, that's what's happening.
That would be terrible for me. It would ruin me.
It's a problem. It's definitely a problem. So, the length of his hair was just noticeably uneven, but underneath it was an absolutely frightening face. Quote, no chin was visible. His face just seemed to blend right into his throat. The visitor had no detectable ears. His eyes were small and lacked eyebrows. When the being opened his mouth, he had three large teeth on the top and bottom. The dome of the skull was covered with the coarsest hair imaginable. It looked as if he had straw growing out of his head. The being's hair was golden and poked up a few inches from his scalp. Two antenna-like rods, longer than his hair, stood out. Their skin had a yellowish-green tinge to it. Without any prior communication, this creature said, "How you doing?" Yeah, that's...
Well, see, I want to know what the inflection was, though. Was it more like
right?
Because that's important. How you doing? Was it like that? You know,
right. So, to put this being into perspective, and we're gonna get a name here in a little bit. He's gonna introduce himself, but the images that I've seen online, and because you know, I'm good friends with Rob Morphy from the Kryptonaut podcast. He's drawn this figure. I believe the best way that we've described it is a cross between Napoleon Dynamite, Beavis from Beavis and Butthead, and a piece of celery. Like, I think that about nails it.
That's accurate. I was going to say he has kind of like a scarecrow motif going on.
Just he does. General,
it's kind of a scarecrow-y kind of guy. But somehow a little bit less featureless and more terrifying.
Yes, just absolutely terrifying. So Carl tried to stay completely calm. And he responded with a weak, "Pretty good."
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to be rude.
No.
Some bizarre-looking entity approaches you and, you know, just asks how you're doing. You don't want to scream and run away. That was just poor etiquette when dealing with space beings, so.
Yeah. If you find yourself in a situation where you're staring down an otherworldly being, you don't want to be the aggressor in this case. Or you don't want to seem like your aggression could unleash some unholy hell from whatever depths this being crawled out of. Yeah,
and you don't want to offend them, you know. It's, no. Yeah, basically he clearly cares because he asked how he was doing, you know. So he's an empathetic being of some sort.
We hope he's an empathetic being of some sort.
But he also didn't have hands, right? Because that's
the
part about this guy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He's got, like, cones for hands.
So on his, I believe it's his right hand, he has like this cone shaped thing on the end of it. And then on his left hand, it ends in a nub. That's it. Like, this is a difficult life here. Well, I shouldn't say it's a difficult life because, he probably, you know, he's got the powers of telekinesis here, which we'll get into. but this being was wearing a skin tight suit, quote, similar to a wetsuit scuba divers wear. And around the midsection was a thick metal belt with a 6-pointed star on the middle, in the middle of it, and some type of harness that seemed to go around their chest. This being didn't have hands. One arm seemed to end in a stump, while the other looked to have, like, they call it the drill bit appendage, because it
right,
really...
That's what it reminds me of, is, yeah. Wasn't there one of the characters in, like, Puppet Master? One of the puppets had, like, drills for hands?
No, we're not talking about Puppet Master. I'm not talking about Puppet Master. You are using my own tweets against me, sir, and I don't appreciate that.
Well, you know, it's just, it came up. It's relevant. I'm sorry.
I refuse to acknowledge your relevancy, especially when I regret that tweet now. I completely regret that tweet. I may delete it later. But I'm not sure.
You can't take it back. Now I know what your kryptonite is, Christofferson.
Damn it. Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, puppets and little dolls that somehow trip Telly Savalas down some stairs. Yeah. That's my weakness. It's my weakness.
All right. Fair enough. We'll move on from that. I'll just keep that little detail in my back pocket, you know?
Oh. You don't need to keep anything about that in your back pocket. You can just let that go into the ether. It doesn't need to come up ever again. That's completely fine.
It'll be between you and me and whoever listens to this show.
It's a few thousand people. God damn it.
Right. No, you're just going to get puppet tweets sent to you all the time.
So many.
People don't do that. Be nice to Rob. Don't be like me. Be nice to Rob.
please don't subject me to that. So the being asked if Carl was hungry, but before he could respond, he waved his pointed appendage at an object, and it started to levitate over towards him. Quote, I opened the packet and found 4 pills inside. He told me, in English, to take one of them. That it would last 4 days. Now, normally I don't like taking pills, not even an aspirin, but something happened. It's as if I had no control over my actions. So I just swallowed one of them and put the other 3 into my jacket pocket. So there's now this motif, which is interesting, that Carl now introduces, in which... like, we call this an abduction case, and it's just... He thinks he assumes that he doesn't have any choice in the matter. It's just, well, this being is asking me a question, and then he's shoving some pills at me. So I guess, again, not to be rude, I'll take his pill.
Something tells me that Carl wouldn't fare well in the big city.
Look, man, I'm going to tell you right here and right now. There's going to be members of a band called Railroad Earth, and they're going to approach you on the street, and they're going to try to hand you a CD, okay? I've been there. I still have that CD somewhere. It's okay to deny them. It's okay to say no. I just want you to know that.
Well, he's like an intergalactic pill pusher, you know? Like, I live in the second biggest city in New England, and I could tell you there's been many times I've walked around the corner of a building and had somebody just, you know, shoving stuff in my face. Hey man, want to buy this? Usually they want money for it, but you know.
Right. It's you know, one step, I would say it's probably about even with an MLM scheme. So yeah, definitely. If you're from the city, if you're from any city, I'm sure plenty of people, they're like, yep, totally encountered this before. The being introduced himself as Ozzo One. And that was when Carl noticed it. Behind the strange man was a transparent cube-shaped object glinting in the sun. Quote, to me, it looked like a huge Christmas package. It was about 5 feet tall, 7 feet long, and 4.5 feet wide. So we've got some shiny Christmas presents just in the woods.
Some huge shiny Christmas presents.
Yeah, like it is Christmas. Christmas has come early for Carl Higdon. Or is it Halloween?
Well, it's 2 months early. It is right around Halloween because it was October 25th, right? Mm-hmm. So, yep.
Yep. This is a different kind of Christmas, Carl. You didn't even know that the Nightmare Before Christmas was going to happen at some point, but here we are. Looking over at the object and back at the being, the figure asked, "Do you want to come along?" Carl shrugged, just feeling like he had no choice. Again. And yeah, it's just, I guess you're going along, bud.
It's not that hard to talk Carl into stuff, I guess, you know.
Did you have so Carl was featured on an episode of In Search Of in 1978. I forget what the heck it was called. I think it was like the UFO. Yeah, I can't remember exactly what the heck it was called. Have you ever watched it?
Yeah, because they highlighted like three or four different cases in that one episode, right?
Yeah.
So he was one of them, because another one was like, I think Canadian, and the flying saucer landed behind the school or something like that. I remember that one more. But yeah, I watched it fairly recently, actually, like a year or two ago. I just happened to watch it, but I don't remember necessarily his part in it.
So, yeah, I think it was called the UFO Captives. That's right. The UFO Captives. And Carl definitely seems like a mild-mannered kind of dude. I don't know if it's just because, you know, following the experience, he became a little more mild-mannered, but there is this...
He said he was a police officer, too, right? I mean... He's like a pushover cop, too, you know?
Right.
Why don't you just, officer, why don't you just go ahead and not write me that ticket? Well, all right, if you say so. Have a good day, sir.
Yeah, just, it's fine. You know, it's towards the end of the day. You know, let's just not do this right now.
Oh, hell, it's almost quitting time anyway. All right. I'm going to go hunt me some elk.
quote, "Before I was able to move a muscle, I found myself inside this contraption. It was instantaneous. How I was able to fit inside remains a riddle. They must have shrunk me. That's the only explanation that seems plausible. My memory fails me here. I recall my head starting to reel. My hands sweating," so he's like Eminem at the beginning of 8 Mile, "and somehow the pill this fellow gave me must have deadened at least some of my senses. Otherwise, I'm positive I would have been crying and perhaps even fainted. I may be strong, but I'm only human." I appreciate that, Carl, because I would be crying too.
Yeah, I mean, he's been through a lot.
Yes. He's been through an incredible amount of
in the
trauma.
Last couple of minutes, you know.
Yes.
But I mean, it didn't occur to me upon first reading that, you know, they actually made him smaller.
Right.
And that's funny that was his impression. I wonder if he was just like a Jefferson Airplane fan. I'm just thinking like the White Rabbit song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe just a big fan of Alice in Wonderland, but
maybe
he clearly wasn't a fan of Doctor Who, because
no,
it seems that it's just TARDIS-like and it's bigger on the inside.
Yeah. Also, I don't think they got the BBC, you know, in the States back in the day. So
probably not in Wyoming.
No, definitely not in Wyoming. So in a transparent partition inside, he could see the five elk just calmly standing there, completely sedate. Carl was now strapped down to a high-backed bucket seat. Both his arms and legs were restrained by metallic bands that had emerged automatically from each side of the chair. Just then, a second being, who looked exactly like Ozzo 1, appeared, and together they placed a bizarre wire-covered football-like helmet on his head. Quote, I felt like the monster in an old Frankenstein movie.
Wait, so was the identical being Ozzo 2?
That, you know, that is a mystery that is going to remain with us for the rest of time, because I have heard a bunch of podcasters say, so is this Ozzo 2? And I think it's got to be. It's either got to be Ozzo, or maybe it's like some like random Ozzo 375. I'm not sure. I don't know how many Ozzos there are, or if, you know, his name was Buzzo, or, you know,
Bozo.
Kind of. Yeah, yeah. Bozo. Exactly. Exactly.
All right, yeah. Ozzo B. Ozob. Who knows? The possibilities are endless.
I've come to call these beings the Ozzians, which is confusing for, you know, the Aussies down in Australia. But I think it fits in this case just because Ozzo 1 is the only one that we know. But because Carl's about to take a trip here real quick. And inside this, he called it the cubicle. There was a console that featured three distinct levers of different sizes and shapes. With Ozzo 1 at the helm, he lifted up one of his arms, and it, through telekinesis, he was able to move the levers up and down. So I want to know, how do we get telekinesis? Because I always hear these stories about aliens telling us that we're not there yet, we're not ready for, you know, the telekinetic stuff, we're not ready for the telepathy. So I want to know, what do we need to do to get there?
You have to get rid of your hands.
Okay, so
that's because you don't need both. So you can either have hands and not telekinesis, or you can have the telekinesis and no hands. You know, that's
okay. I'm taking down notes right now. No hands.
Yeah, just get rid of the hands. You just need a cone hand, like you know, the drill puppet and Puppet Master, or no, that thing had a drill head. Now I remember.
Damn it.
No, but in all seriousness, actually, there are ways that you can develop your psychokinetic ability, and there are places that you know, there are resources for that. I know what was her name, Shirley Black, that was on Where Did the Road Go a lot back in the day. She has been able to do it in a laboratory setting, and there's different methods. You can pretty easily set up an edgely wheel. Is Eggly or Edgely? I'm not really sure how it's pronounced, but it's you set up a little wheel on top of a needle that's stuck into a cork, and then you put it under a glass dome so that it can't be affected by your breath or a breeze, and then you can practice with that, like try to move the wheel around in your mind. I have had psychokinetic effects in my life, or at least that's what I thought they were. I kind of grew up with poltergeist type activity, and I always kind of thought it was my own, my own unconscious psychokinesis, or the recurring spontaneous psychokinesis. So I believe it is possible. I never did really learn how to control it. So I'm kind of grateful it doesn't happen so much these days, because it could get messy sometimes. But
I think the real reason why you couldn't control it is because you have two hands.
Exactly. So if I had even lopped off one of them, and then I could maybe replace it with a chainsaw or something cool.
Yeah.
And have telekinesis, that's kind of the best of both worlds, you know?
It is. Like, it could probably be made into a movie.
It probably could. Yeah. And then you could throw a Necronomicon in there for good measure.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, you know, it's the buzziest, like, occult book out there. even if it is fake. So, once the object lifted into the air, Ozzo pointed his arm to the truck, to Carl's truck that was on the ground, and it vanished immediately. I like aliens that can make things disappear. It's pretty damn cool.
Yeah, that's actually more impressive than telekinesis.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I want to, like, is the Invisible Man based off of an alien encounter? I'm going to wonder that for the rest of my life. So that's just how it goes. So the trip was almost instantaneous as they arrived in a bright new world in just mere moments. Quote, and the next thing I can remember is looking down and there's this big ball, like a basketball. And from Carl Higdon's description, I think we can assume that the surface of this planet was like orange, because that's like that's what I picture in my head. Like, either
most basketballs are orange, so
yeah. So we got a like a Mars-like planet here. And it was incredibly bright on its surface, and it hurt Carl to look at it. There was one feature that actually stood out, and it was an incredibly tall tower that he likened to the Space Needle. And in his sketch, Carl drew this kind of like luminous umbrella looking thing that was like atop a pole. Quote, all around this tower were revolving patterns of multicolored lights, not unlike powerful spotlights. They were so intense that it was actually painful to keep my eyes open. These lights were so brilliant that I held my hands to my face as a protective shield. I vaguely remember shouting, "Shut them off! They're burning me!" I just couldn't tolerate them. After Carl yelled to the Aussians to shut off the lights like he was Eddie Vedder in the music video for Evenflow, the Aussian figure that had first appeared in the craft offered little comfort, proclaiming, "Your son burns us too."
Look, buddy, it's no picnic being on your planet. Yeah.
We gotta wear these black, like, I don't know, weird looking outfits just to step foot on your planet.
Do you have any idea what your son does to my hair?
Exactly. I forget exactly, because there's we're going to get at the end of this. We're going to talk briefly about Philip J. Class. But there was in the article that was that featured him, there was a mention of like some like weird rock star, like just out in the woods, because I you kind of get that vibe looking at Ozzo One.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like glam rock, something like that. Yeah.
I think David Bowie could have done wonders with that. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, it's so weird looking though. I mean, it's more like a Gary Glitter of the cosmos. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's fair. That is fair. So below the tower, Carl saw a small group of people that looked like normal average human beings in clothing that resembled what we wear on Earth. And they were conversing in normal fashion. There were two adults and three children. One was a man, one was a woman. And I think there were two boys and one girl. Their ages range from about 10 to 14, and the adults were a little bit older. They had some gray in their hair. But after the craft had fully landed, the two beings escorted Carl down a long hallway. They didn't walk, but floated. And I think that's something that I want from aliens, the ability to float. That seems like, for one, it's the only way that you can up Chris Angel. It's the only way.
Well, it's all part and parcel of the same kind of mental aptitude, I think. You know, if you have telekinesis, you can make yourself fly. You know, it's the same superpower, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe their craft operates that way too.
Could be. It could very well be. All I know is that whatever these aliens are on, it's way better than that Chris Angel magic kit that he was selling there a few years ago.
Well, I think we skipped a part too, because they took the elk with them.
Yes, they did take the elk with them. So not only were there
Ozzo 1 and Ozzo 2 in the craft with Carl, but the elk were in the same vessel, right?
Yes, they were absolutely in the same vessel. They were kind of in this weird looking partition, just like standing there chilled out, kind of just like for elk. These are extremely mellow elk. Like, they defy what I assume elk are supposed to do.
He stumbled upon them in the midst of chowing down on a hemp farm somewhere. The elk are just like, cool, man.
Yeah, hell yeah, dude. Let's just go for a ride.
Really hungry. I don't know about you, but...
Yeah, that's completely fair. That's completely fair. So they floated down this hallway, this extremely long hallway, and there was a brief examination that was conducted. He was told that he was not what the beings were looking for and was promptly escorted back to the craft.
Oh, you got Bertude.
Yeah. We'll mention Bertu at the end of this thing, but it's terrible. The examination involved an odd device that Higdon described as a, quote, glassy shield, which emerged from the wall and paused in front of the hunter for approximately 5 minutes before retracting back into the wall. Carl was told that he did not suit their purposes and was just promptly escorted out of there. So it seems kind of insulting to bring someone all the way to your planet only to tell them that you are not what they're looking for. It's absolute crap. I mean, why would you not have something up front to not waste somebody's time and subject them to all this trauma?
Yeah. I mean, and he's, you know, he was so pliable too. He just went right along with everything. Like, doesn't he at least get a gold star for being cooperative?
Should. if I would totally mail him a star right now. I'm pretty sure Carl Higdon is still alive. I did not find an obituary for him. So if he is, gold star, man. Totally.
I mean, they both had one on their belt, I think, right?
But yeah.
Yeah. I just picture like a little kid's like sheriff badge on the belt. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of what I picture.
Yeah, that's bringing me back. That's totally bringing me back. Definite authority figure. Right. Going on here. Once he was safely back inside, quote, Ozzo One tells me they have been coming to Earth for many years. They come in search of fish and animals. Their food is in the form of pills. One pill will last for 3 days. They make pills from fish and animals. Their ocean is yellow, and all the fish have died. He shows me a landmass map of his planet. He tells me we are 163,000 light miles from Earth. So that's an interesting phrase right there, light miles. Mm-hmm. That does not track.
Nope.
No, it just seems like I think these aliens are really fucking with them now. They're just fucking with them.
Right. Yeah, because they're talking always about fish pills and light miles, and none of this is adding up anymore.
Exactly. Well, it's just like he gets one view from like a city that he can barely see because it's just too bright for him. And now they're just like, yeah, we our rivers are yellow. We don't have fish anymore. It's kind of bad for us.
Maybe that's letting him down easy, though, because they felt like, you know, they rejected him. But then they're like, yeah, man, you don't want to live here anyway. Just look at our shitty yellow rivers. And we don't even have fish. You can't fish here. So, don't you want to go home and fish?
So, yeah.
But exactly. We have heard of aliens abducting fish before, too. Thinking about, like, the Ray Fowler, the Betty and Jason case. There was a moment where the aliens seemed to, I think they had a tube where they were sucking fish up from a pond in Ashburnham or something like that.
Yeah, it seems a bit much, you know. Aliens, they seem to dig water. I'm assuming it's as valuable for them as it is for us. And according to these aliens, according to the Ozzians, the 9 planets of our solar system supply the magnetic force for our power. Pretty cool. Okay. Just using us, not really.
So our solar system is like a power generator for them.
Yeah, pretty much.
We're all power plant workers.
Oh God, it's the Matrix when when Morpheus is holding up the battery and Neo's just like, no, no. Yeah. This is
the Matrix because there's pills involved too.
Oh God.
I wanted to know if it was like the blue pill or the red pill or what's going on. But
oh man. Quote, he takes my rifle. He studies it. He said he would like to keep it. It is a primitive weapon, but he is not allowed to. As a fun little piece of commentary, in the book that Carl's wife published in 2017, there's this like in bold letters. Like, this book is terribly formatted. If you go and buy it, it's great. There's a lot of great, you know, insight and details and stuff, but it's terribly formatted. And in bold print, it says, "Primitive, I just bought it."
Well, you know, and who's he to criticize? Because how is he going to use a gun with no hands? I mean, exactly. I guess he's just going to use like telekinesis to fire a weapon.
Exactly. He tells me that they wear black because our sun burns them, which is okay. Let's unpack that statement for a second. If our sun burns them, why are you wearing black? Because black attracts like sun rays. Like, why? Yeah. Why would you? It makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Yeah, every goth that's ever lived in a warm climate understands that, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
You can't complain about the heat. If you can't take the heat, don't be goth, is basically...
Yeah.
If you're going to be around our sun anyway, so...
Yeah. Exactly. The patches are symbols of their planet, so he's talking about on their belts. That is the symbol of their planet. He said he is a hunter. After handing his gun back to him, or floating it over to him, Ozzo-1 pulled the pack of pills that he had placed in his coat pocket, because we can't have too much evidence in this case. Again, the trip back was instantaneous. The ship approached the blue marble Earth and hovered above the forest. We'll see you. Are Ozzo-1's final words to Carl before he floats to the ground. He comes down hard on some loose stones on the side of a hill, and his foot slips as he falls to the ground, hurting his shoulder pretty bad. Hmm. Carl was in a complete state of confusion. He could see a sign that read, North Boundary, Lincoln Forest, but he had no idea where that was. He later determined that he was approximately 5 miles from the clearing where he had been taken. So they're not accurate. They're just dropping him off kind of close to where he was. You know, it's these Brazilian teleportation cases all over again.
No courtesy at all, really. You know,
no, these aliens have no chill, and it shows. Like, it completely shows.
Yeah. Yep. And they didn't even put him anywhere near his truck either.
No, but we got an interesting little tidbit about the truck here in a second. So Carl walked down a 3-mile stretch of dirt road. Quote, I didn't know what had happened, who I was or where I was, for that matter. The only thing I could think of was to get out of there as fast as possible and find someone who could help me. He even walked past his truck, which had mysteriously been transported to the area, which was extremely rugged and just muddy as all hell. And it was a very unlikely place to find that truck. It would be extremely difficult for the truck to actually get to where it was ultimately found. Quote,
yeah, I think he described it as a place that he never would have tried to drive into. Because it was a two-wheel drive truck or something like that, right? Like,
yeah, it wasn't, it wasn't built Ford Tough, or it was maybe, I don't know.
Did you say it was a company truck?
Yes, it was. It was a company truck. Yeah,
probably gonna be in deep shit when he comes back. What did you do to the company truck?
Like, Carl, like, he told me you could handle this. And
Carl, you're taking the company truck elk hunting again. What did I tell you about that? Get one day off and you wreck the company truck.
Like, our insurance is not going to cover an active alien. It's just not going to happen. since I was in a state of mental stress, this fact did not have any impact on me until sometime later. I know that I could never have driven over that impossible terrain, even if I had been physically capable of driving, which I most certainly was not. He could hear voices coming from the cab, and he climbed inside and could hear two voices. One of them was a female coming over a CB radio. Quote, there was a two-way set under the dashboard, so I picked up the mic and I held it close to my mouth. I managed to blurt out that I was sick and lost and desperately in need of assistance. When the voice on the other end asked me where I was, I told them I had seen a sign down the road which read North Boundary, Lincoln Forest. This didn't seem to be much help. However, there was absolutely no indication as to what forest the sign was referring to. So, that's interesting. Just kind of doesn't...
Yeah, I mean, if it's just the boundary line, it's just kind of... Well, that doesn't narrow it down.
No.
Probably anywhere along a 40-mile stretch or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So, it was around 6:30 p.m. by the time Carl picked up the two-way receiver. It was growing cold and dark, and he desperately wanted to find his way out. Around the same time, Carl's wife, Marjorie, was growing nervous. At 7 p.m., she received a phone call from Buddy Rossiker, who was Carl's boss, asking her what he had done with his truck, which he had borrowed to go hunting. 20 minutes later, Buddy called back. Carl had been found. He was radioing from the truck. He sounded delirious, which prompted Marjorie to grab her coat and head out. Carl struggled at first to work that walkie, but when he did, he expressed over and over again that he didn't know who he was or where he was. All he knew was that he was on this road not far from that boundary. The woman was a dispatcher out of Riverton. She advised Carl to stay in the truck so that they would be able to find him instead of, you know, wandering around the forest. So he would utter phrases on occasion like, where are my elk? And my pickup just disappeared. She checked in on him every 5 minutes or so, advising him not to leave the truck at any cost.
Yeah.
The search party for Carl Higdon was led by Sheriff Ogburn, Deputy Sheriff Ed Tierney, Roy Fleming, Dave Martin, Harold Schultz, Marjorie Higdon, and two of her friends who were there for moral support, Marilyn and Don James. They also had like a, I think they had a four-wheel drive or something like that. Marjorie Higdon basically called them to have them bring her out. The sheriff had requested a helicopter search, but the pilot had a couple of beers and was unfortunately unable to fly. So, you know, it was totally down to ground search at this point.
Yeah, that's rough.
Mm-hmm. That's a problem. That's a problem. But I understand if you're off shift, anything goes, you know, yeah. especially on a Friday night. I understand.
It's like the one helicopter guy around.
Yeah. God damn it, Jim. I told you to hire somebody else. Yeah.
Wasn't he saying like they took my elk? Wasn't that like all he would say at one point was?
Yeah.
Yeah. That just kind of that. I mean, that's kind of funny in a way, but it's also I could see that being really chilling, where you just hear him over a CB radio. They took my elk. They took him.
Yeah.
Because they brought him back, but they didn't bring the elk back. So
yeah.
The elk passed whatever test that was with the nozzle thingy coming out of the wall. So
yeah, the elk were totally fine. Carl, we're gonna get into why Carl thinks he was rejected at the end of this thing, and you know, it's it happens, stuff like that happens. So the parties kept getting stuck in the mud and having to pull each other out every single time. Again, this area was not a place you would be driving into and getting probably as deep as Carl, you know, found that truck. So when Marjorie, Marilyn, and Don had arrived, the sheriff advised them not to leave their vehicle. Just given how difficult the terrain was, it was, you know, completely understandable. As Timothy Green Beckley wrote in a 1975 article about this case, quote, As they sat shivering in the damp night air, all three saw the forest suddenly come alive with an eerie phosphorescence. The trees appeared to be ablaze. All around us, the area was lit brightly, as if the full moon had settled down somewhere amongst the trees. It was so light, I believe you could have spotted a dime on the road. Several minutes later, a strange aerial display erupted. A light bobbed above a nearby grove of trees. At first, we thought it might be an airplane circling overhead, but it was too much too low, and traveling much too slowly. We didn't hear a sound coming from it. We also ruled out it being a helicopter since we had asked for an aerial search and were told that none could be arranged before morning.
The helicopter pilot just had a few more and was like, "Ah, what the hell?"
Yeah, we're going to do this hungover tomorrow morning. The minutes passed and then a brilliant flash was seen coming from the forest. I jumped for joy, figuring they had found my husband and were bringing him out. However, this wasn't the case, since the shortwave radio in our vehicle, tuned to the police broadcast band, advised us that they were still searching for Carl. Around midnight, Marilyn James, who had been staring out the window, let out a soft cry and pointed to the sky in the direction of a hovering light. It moved. Wearily, her husband Don mumbled that we should try to get some sleep, that it was going to be a long vigil, and besides, the object was probably just a star. To this, his wife answered, "Well, if it's only a star, why is it moving and making loops?" That's a great question, Marilyn. Totally valid question that I hope Don really thought about that for a second.
Don's just really used to dealing with Carl and not Marilyn, because if he had said that to Carl, Carl would have been like, "Yeah, you're right."
Yeah, totally. Totally. It's kind of like that that old Japanese case that I think it's in Passport to Magonia, where these like Japanese soldiers see some like lights in the sky and they say that it was like the moon swaying in the wind. Yeah, it's that all over again.
But I mean, maybe you have to wonder if that was his reaction because he was just trying to calm things down and he was, trying to protect people. That was his only way of protection, is maybe we should get some rest. Or
that's fair.
Or people just do act strangely in these scenarios. When you hear about all manner of nighttime visitations in people's bedrooms and then they end up rolling over and going to sleep. Or, you know, have odd reactions sometimes that are counterintuitive.
It's so. That damn Mike Clellan story where he talks about being like sitting in bed reading and he sees a bright light outside and he goes to the window and he sees the aliens approaching his house and he just gets in bed and goes to sleep. I don't like that. I'll just deal with that
in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Sure. That's the cosmic cross that bridge when we get to it. Absolutely. So we watched dumbfounded as it blinked alternately red, white, and green. Their sighting took place long before they learned of Carl's bizarre ordeal. The light continued to make its appearance over other hills as bright as the sunrise. The three in the truck were trying to get some sleep when the call came out over the CB. "We have Carl, but we are going out a different way. It will be a lot easier to go out by the gate at the bottom. Meet us there." They kept noticing this orange light in the sky. It was almost like it was watching. Finally, the search party reached the gate. When Marjorie ran to her husband, Carl only seemed to look right through her. His blank stare was troubling. She asked him if he got his elk. He responded, "They took my elk. They took my elk." And he just kept saying it over and over again. Marjorie tried to cover him with a blanket, but when she did, he cried out, "Don't touch me."
Oh, geez.
Carl then stared out the windshield, up into the sky, and repeated in a sing-song voice, "They took my elk. They took my elk." So
Yeah, I mean, it really sounds like trauma. You know, like, he's very traumatized right now.
Yeah, he's not having a good time. Quote, they immediately took me to the nearest hospital where I was placed under day and night observation. Not until the following evening did I begin to regain my memory and start to recall a few details of my ordeal. Carl was admitted to Carbon County Memorial Hospital at Rawlins at around 2 a.m. He was rushed to the ER where he was subjected to tests, which is, you know, tests in the tests on the planet, tests in the hospital. Just so many tests here.
Yeah, he's really put through the ringer.
You know? He's really just going through it. X-rays were taken, blood as well as blood samples and an echocardiogram. All of the tests came back negative. He was still delirious in the ER, and he kept talking about the bits and pieces he remembered from his ordeal. His doctor, Dr. Tonko, who was he was actually new in town, he'd started to write down these phrases, things like 163,000 light miles and cone hands and floating. Carl would have a violent reaction to bright lights whenever they were turned on. His memory was slow to return. He would call his wife, quote, the pretty lady from the emergency room.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. That's not going to end well.
Well, at least he said she was pretty.
Yeah, absolutely.
Could have gone another way, but...
Carl started to remember more and more during his hospital stay. Marjorie gave him a piece of paper, and he started to sketch the being known as Ozzo 1. He wrote down words and phrases like four-day pills and enders. The word enders is believed to refer to the park ranger that he ran into earlier that day, which was Eaton. Right. He wrote down two addresses from a time when he lived in San Antonio, Texas, and he drew the inside of the craft and the console with the levers on it. When Marjorie went home later that day, she brought his possessions into the house. She was exhausted by the whole ordeal, but was given pause when a mangled piece of metal fell out of the pouch of Carl's canteen. She promptly put the metal on the bureau and went to bed. So I just want to emphasize to everybody that's listening right now, everybody involved in this case, except for Carl, does not know that Carl had a UFO sighting. So all of this stuff that we're talking about, the sighting of lights, this, mangled piece of metal that she gets, she doesn't know what has happened to him at this point.
Right. And he doesn't even really know. He's just kind of putting little pieces together, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So the next day, she took this metal fragment to the sheriff's office, who confirmed that it was indeed a 7mm magnum shell casing, and that it looked as if it had been turned inside out. The sheriff would go no further, though, and refused to conduct tests on the bullets. He kept saying, just let it be. Okay. I get it. Let's not stir things up. But later on, the Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization, or APRO, sent Dr. Walter Walker, and I feel sorry for that guy. Like, your parents named you Walter Walker. Well, they gave you Walter, and I feel, as someone who was asked if he was related to Kris Kristofferson his entire life, I totally get anybody who has names that could seem a bit troubling, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's not very creative.
No. No, it's like I just covered the New Berlin landing with Tobias Weiland, and and Ted Blocher gave the main witness the pseudonym of Mary Merriweather.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that maybe some UFO investigators need to take a lesson in how to at least, you know, what would be great is if they consulted a book of like Dungeons and Dragons NPC names. I think if we went that way, it would be so much more amazing. The names would be so much more interesting and just recognizable. It'd be great.
Yeah, there you go. We need to spice it up a little bit.
Yeah, it's about time that we get.
Why do the ETs have all the interesting names?
You know? Yeah, exactly. I think we need the rebrand when it comes to, you know, anonymous names within UFO case lore. So after conducting rigorous tests, he determined that the object impacted an immense solid surface with a force stronger than the gun could produce. So that's interesting. So it gets into that time distortion that you were talking about, because essentially what he's saying is like pretty much the opposite of what would have had to have happened. Like, this bullet would have had to have been traveling incredibly fast, and it would have had to like hit something that was incredibly hard.
Yeah, right. I mean, that would be the easiest explanation, is if like you shot reinforced steel or something and it just bounced off. But for it to fall out of midair like that, it's a mind boggler. I really don't know how to explain that. Unless there was like a force field. Maybe there was some kind of force field there that they put around the elk. An invisible force field.
You know? That's fair. I don't want you shooting my elk. I got to bring those back. And we're going to get into why he had to bring those back. So, in Alien Abduction of the Wyoming Hunter, published in 2017, Marjorie Higdon wrote, quote, "Carl's memory returned when his oldest daughter, Rose, came into the hospital room. It was like he was programmed to get his memory back when he saw her." So that's an interesting, phrase. That's an interesting, couple sentences right there.
Yeah, it smacks of like post-hypnotic suggestion, you know?
Yep. Also, it suggests that Ozzo 1 knew more about Carl than, just some random encounter in Medicine Bow National Forest.
Well, he seemed pretty familiar with him, just walking up and saying, "How you doing?"
Yeah, exactly. Like, we've been watching you for a while.
Next time you see your daughter, this will all be more clear.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So Carl was subsequently discharged from the hospital and took a 3-week respite. He didn't leave his home except for the occasional walk in the backyard. And he pretty much struggled with the reality of his experience, often waking up in the middle of the night, just like questioning the reality of everything that had happened to him. And he was actually too scared to drive his own truck. So, clearly we've got signs of trauma here. And there is one interesting medical anomaly in Carl's chart. So in 1958, Carl had been hospitalized after contracting tuberculosis. And then following his hospital stay, his lungs actually showed significant signs of scar tissue following the hospitalization. But when Carl went into the hospital following the trip to the Aussie and world, that scar tissue was apparently no longer present on the x-ray. So we've got disappearing scar tissue.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the bright lights hurt, but they probably did something good for him too,
Right, exactly. It's like that, what the heck is that? The Georgia Stocks case where the aliens cured that guy of his cancer and then he died like months later from, I think, a different form of cancer or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but it's been a while since I read that one. But yeah, the Georgia Stocks case.
I think with Buck Nelson too. I think Buck Nelson was cured of something.
Yes. Yep.
I don't remember what it was though.
Yeah. That's another interesting, because I don't usually do contactees, but he's like one of my favorites. He's definitely up there with like just like how innocuous he was and like how genuine he seemed.
Yeah. He's definitely a special one. He's kind of an outsider. He doesn't fit the mold. There's no real hucksterism about him necessarily.
No, he's not a grifter. in right. any way. So
he just is who he is. But yeah, I mean, I feel like I now can't remember what it was, but I feel like he had some kind of, was it like his eyesight or something? Or
yeah, I think so. Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I mean, the aliens clearly can cure us of stuff. So that's
they can.
A cool thing.
Yeah, it's great when they help us out every now and then. They also have the ability to mess with Ed Walters' pool pump, which seemed to be a real problem for him down in Gulf Breeze. Just that pool pump was failing damn near every day. So,
right. Well, mechanical failures are just the price you have to pay when you're getting medical treatment from the Aussians. So.
Yeah. Yep. Just bound to happen. So. Carl took interviews and talked to investigators Rick Nansky and Dr. Leo Sprinkle, rest in peace. Also,
yeah, lost
Timothy
him last year.
Yeah, also yeah. Timothy Green Beckley, rest in peace. He was a professor of psychology at the University of Wyoming and a card-carrying member of the Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization. Through multiple hypnosis sessions with Dr. Sprinkle, additional details of Carl's sighting emerged. He
wait,
claimed
wait.
That
I just have to stop right here because
yep.
we were talking about names earlier, and I just want to appreciate the name Dr. Leo Sprinkle.
Yes, it is. From okay, like for one, it's just a baller ass name that is definitely hilarious in and of itself, but. From what I understand, the man was incredibly kind and incredibly passionate, especially towards UFO experiencers and such. And
yeah, he's huge in the field and the kind yep. of, you know, he was kind of early with the hypnotism and stuff like that. But before that was a big thing, I think, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it had been around, but he was kind of an authority in that respect. And he yep. seemed to go about it a lot more ethically than, I guess, you know, later examples would. So,
yeah,
gotta
exactly.
give a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, he also conducted the hypnosis of Myrna Hansen in Paul Benowitz's car in his garage. So, I mean, that says a lot about his character and what he's willing to do to, you know, help out those who have experienced something very traumatic.
Right. Yeah.
So he claimed that the Aussians had come to Earth in search of food, equating the planet with a game reserve. The way in which Carl talked about the aliens' planet is as if the resources had all gone bad. Rivers are polluted. They're yellow. They don't have any fish or anything like that. So they're taking all of our fish and they're turning them into these dang, you know, pills. They have no sense of cuisine on that planet. And we don't even know what that planet's called. So is the we'll just call the planet Ozzo One now, too, because that's just the way it is.
Ozzo World.
Ozzo World. I think we've got a theme park idea. Hell yeah. So they took the elk back to their planet for, quote, breeding purposes. And for all intents and purposes, Ozzo One seemed to be a conservationist and a game warden himself. Breeding was also why the Aussians took interest in human beings. Given that Carl had previously had a vasectomy, he assumed that that was the reason they rejected him. Quote, maybe this is what they meant when they said I wasn't any good. I kind of sense that they wanted younger people, end quote.
Wow.
Yep.
So at least they didn't tell him he was too old and infirm for their.
Oh, purposes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Higdon's rejection recalls the near abduction that Alfred Berteau experienced in 1980. While fishing in England, the World War II veteran followed a pair of figures to a craft. After stepping underneath a light, he was dismissed by a voice that said, "You can go. You are too old and infirm for our purposes."
Poor Berteau.
I appreciate that they're blunt and to the point, but it's just like, I think you need that human nuance that to understand that maybe let people down a little bit easier. Just going
yeah.
forward.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they don't really get delicacy, being delicate in that respect. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So
Yeah. So 4 years after his abduction had taken place, Carl Higdon agreed to a polygraph test, and he passed with flying colors. So that was the stress-inducing one or whatever. But he passed it, no problem. Carl Higdon's abduction is one of the most baffling cases on record. It's a rare that evidence such as the bullet casing, the disappearing scar tissue, and the mere impossible location of the truck exist in cases like this. It's not often, aside from like scoop marks, that you really see anything like that. That being said, the abduction of Carl Higdon did have its detractors. In the column, of all things, Dick Bothwell asked Philip J. Klass about the Higdon case. Quote, "That's the trouble. Americans are natural-born souvenir hunters. But do you realize that in all these cases we hear about, where people are aboard spaceships, nobody ever thinks to pick up a ballpoint pen or an ashtray? Anything! An artifact!"
I mean, first of all, aliens don't smoke.
Well, I mean, there was that one... we're going to talk about that case next week, that one alien that was going in to buy a pack of smokes, but I think she was
buying them, but that doesn't, yeah. we didn't get any indication that they lit up, you know,
that's fair. That's completely fair. You know, we didn't know if they were going to blaze it or not later.
Well, in a lot of the contactee cases, they make a special point of telling people smoking's really bad for you.
Yeah,
they're just like, why are you guys doing this to yourself? Why do people do that? Like, you jerks, stop smoking. You're hurting yourself.
Yeah. I think there was at one point during the Antonio Villas-Boas abduction when he saw something that was on a table that I think he equated to an ashtray, and he tried to pick it up, but they just like tackled him and was like, no, you're not taking that with you. Mm-hmm. It would only take one device made with a technology unknown on Earth to demonstrate for once and all that there are indeed extraterrestrial spaceships. Thanks, Phil. Bothwell writes, quote, "Come right down to it. Philip Klass is a spoil sport. If you listen to him, UFO mythology is just that." Klass adds, quote, "The only myths I believe in are romantic love and the tooth fairy."
Yeah. Romantic love? Really? I guess old Phil Klass just wasn't getting any, so romantic love must be a myth.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what in Philip Klass's personal life, if things had been different, would he not have been so uptight about the UFOs? I don't know. It's a question I'm willing to ask, though.
Well, I guess he did believe in it, but he classifies it as a myth. You know, I guess he's being glib, but
yeah.
Classic, yeah. Philip J. S.
Yep.
I like in that same column, though, he basically implies that Klass was an alien himself.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the thing is like, when I was reading Cynthia Hines' book, she mentioned briefly that she liked Philip Klass, that he did believe in UFOs, and that he was like nicer than people made him out to be. And maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. Like, I was talking to someone the other day about how sometimes, like, with some personalities within like the UFO community, like when you see that personality projected onto, you know, into a public space, they're very different than they are private in a private space. So yeah, I kind of get that. I'm sure Philip Klass was like that to a certain extent.
Yeah, and I mean, he seemed to have a sense of humor too. Mm-hmm. And his curse still stands as far as as far as things go. We haven't not made any progress since his death, so despite what some people believe. But no, that's true. And the thing is, like, there is a place for skepticism, absolutely. Like, if you're a true believer, or if you just, like, really, really can't stand those guys that go around debunking things, it's like, no, they have a valuable voice and place in the mixed stew that is ufology, you know? So
yeah,
you need to listen to the different angles, the ones you don't agree with. You maybe should listen to those more sometimes, you know? But
yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's always good to have both sides of the story, and it's always good to make fun of the ones that you don't agree with, especially when they become too absurd. That's just the nature of this stuff. That's what we do.
Yeah, in the case of Class, he's obviously making fun of people too. So,
yeah,
you know, he's just getting back what he puts out. So,
and, I mean, if you really want to see Philip Class, full-on Philip Classing, just look up that YouTube clip of Phil Class on... Oh, the Oprah Winfrey Show, just like tearing into Ed Walters, like regardless of whether you believe Ed Walters or not, I think you could go about it a little more respectfully than just like ripping into the guy. But, yeah. You know, that is what it is.
Yeah, definitely not a class act.
Yep. But that folks right there is the abduction of Carl Higdon, the probably one of the wildest and yet one of the more believable cases of alien abduction that I'm willing to say that, just because that there is a decent amount of evidence. We've got trauma in a mild-mannered dude that doesn't seem to, you know, cotton to this kind of stuff. He's a down-to-earth guy. He gets to work every day, and especially the way that they portrayed him on In Search Of, just not down with this kind of BS in any kind of way. And it must
have been remarkably adaptable too, and easy to change and adjust to the knowledge of what happened to him, because I mean, it didn't really ruin his life. I mean, you see it so often with abductees that their life just completely gets ruined and then has to take a different course. I always think of like the Herbert Shermer case, mm-hmm. or you know, like people that have to like change their name and leave, or
yeah, exactly. Exactly. And
he's still in the same place. He's still married to the same woman, still alive, I guess.
Yeah. There was a wonderful article written about them. We'll include it in the show notes, about him and his wife, who, they were celebrating at that time their 61st wedding anniversary, and they just seemed as happy as and content as ever. So, one thing that, I did take away from the In Search Of, episode is that, he credits his recovery and his ability to deal with what happened to him, Leo Sprinkle and his, you know, his counseling and his hypnosis session. So that's another nod to Dr. Leo Sprinkle. Rest in peace.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that really goes to show the support you get or lack of support, you know, really can determine everything in that case. And I guess that's what makes Dr. Sprinkle a very important figure, and kind of an admirable one, is that he did seem to help people more than anything else, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So he definitely he was one of the good ones. Definitely one of the good ones. So AP, where could people, you know, keep up with you on the internet? Where can they follow along as you now have put into the ethos that people are going to tweet, you know, Puppet Master crap at me, and
don't do that, people.
but where is the best place to follow along with all of the wild and weird stuff that you find?
Well, Twitter is the best. Just search for me there. You'll find AP Strange on Twitter. I have the blog, which doesn't get updated terribly often, except the page where I have a list of all the various podcast stuff I do. appearances that I've made, and more recently hosting. So The Eternal Void, but with jazz, is coming back in a big way. Shell and I have been producing and booking more guests. So by the time this is out, there will already be the interview with Alan Greenfield, which was a trip. That was a hell of a conversation. And we got more stuff coming on that. So if you find The Eternal Void, but with jazz on your podcast player, you'll be able to keep up with us there too.
Yeah, Shell's podcast is absolutely great. So go check that out. And as for us, if you want to help us out, you can leave a rating and review on whatever podcasting app allows you to do that. Spotify allows you to rate things now. Apple Podcasts, very helpful, and all that good stuff. Sharing the show with a friend, sharing Shell's show, The Eternal Void, but with jazz. It's phenomenal. And just knowing how that interview with Greenfield went down, the dude was humming Green Acres. So you can't go wrong with all of that.
There's a lot of singing Greenfield on there.
Yeah, singing Greenfield. You want him in a karaoke bar when things are able to open up and it's all safe and stuff like that. But if you want to support us monetarily, head on over to patreon.com/yourUFOguy, where for $3 a month, you'll get early access to this episode. And we do some bonus episodes over there as well. And AP is going to be coming back with us next week. We're going to be talking about aliens trying to pass off as humans wearing god-awful disguises. So you have that to look forward to. That was a rabbit hole that we recently fell down, and we just found too many cases not to do an episode about it. So that's coming next week. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. You can check out the other projects that I'm a part of by hitting the link tree in the show notes. I am a part of like 3 or 4 podcasts. It's kind of crazy. So special thanks, AP. Thank you again for coming on. And thank you again. Thank you preemptively for coming on next week. And special thanks to Floats for the use of their song UFO for the intro and outro to this program, and to the great Desdemona for designing our logo. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in our strange skies or over the skies of Medicine Bow National Forest. In gray, we trust.